Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's Pizzeria almost every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45. Not joined in the studio today with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. No fault of her own. Do you have any weepy sad track on your thing, Jack?
Let's see.
Wow.
I got that.
That's not like, oh, you're sad she's here. It's like a wah-wah on her. It's really not her fault.
No, like on the airline, maybe?
On Turkish. She got delayed coming back from Istanbul. For some reason, her flight from Greece was connected through Istanbul. No one told those folks that that's the wrong way. That's the wrong way to get back to America, to fly to Turkey via Greece, which is a shame because I wanted to... Should I wait, Jack, for next time to talk about the Greece trip?
Yeah, I think so.
I actually made it to Turkey for a day because I was on the same flight.
Yeah?
But I came back a day early so that I could hang out in Istanbul for a day. Really cool food in Turkey. Really, did you know that Turkish cheese is really interesting, Jack?
No, why?
I just hadn't expected it. They have this. I need to look up the translations because I don't speak any. I don't speak anything other really than English and a smattering of German and, you know, enough French to get me by in the kitchen. But I guess the same Spanish, just enough to like just the kitchen. Anyway, the point is they have this like crazy string cheese thing, but it tastes like beer almost, like it's yellow. They have like a white string cheese that tastes fairly neutral, and they have a yellow string cheese that tastes kind of like fermented, yeasty beer kind of a situation. They have a sheep's milk cheese. That's aged, get ready for it, aged in a goat skin.
What?
Yeah. They have a sheep's milk cheese aged in a goat's skin. Good. Very good. They have some, like, incredibly light, like, buttery cheese. They have some really, really good cheeses. Also, had some really, do you know that they had some very good cured fish in Turkey? Did you know this?
I did not know that either.
We'll talk about it later. They have this, I forget the name of it. Oh, lacerda is the name of it. It's this It's this bonito that comes through the Bosporus that they catch. And then they salt it and lightly brine it and serve it raw. It's like the most velvety, with onions, it's like the most velvety textured fish like ever. It's awesome. Anyway, so big surprise. I didn't even get to go to any, I was in Turkey. I had this Leptonderma. Are you familiar with that, Jack? The stretchy ice cream?
Yeah.
Well, it's the first time I've had it actually there, you know, proper, which is nice. And, you know, you can bring it home. It's not quite the same. They're lying. They say that it's going to be the same. It's not quite the same when you bring it home. I think it needs to be manipulated a little bit. Didn't have quite the bite because I paid some ungodly amount of money to... Do you also know that you can bring dry ice on an airplane as long as nobody asks you?
Well... Yeah, sure. You can bring a lot of stuff as long as nobody asks you.
Well, I mean, they sold it to me on the airplane.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually, when I got home at JFK, it's the first time I've ever been able to actually rationally talk somebody at customs out of anything. They're like, well, you can't bring that in because it's not cheese, so it's not fermented. It's dairy and, you know, may contain eggs. And I said, well, you know, it's cooked. And the straight-faced guy looks at me, he's like, when I make ice cream at home, it's not cooked. Really, he said this to me. I was like, we're going to get in this conversation. I said, okay. I said, there's two basic kinds of ice cream that we eat here in America. You got your Philly-style ice cream, which is does not have egg yolks, typically, and is not cooked. And I was like, this is probably what you're making at home. This is a Breyer-style of ice cream. I said, the other and more typical kind of ice cream is something familiar to more like a Häagen-Dazs or a Ben & Jerry, which contains egg yolks, and is, in fact, cooked and pasteurized before it's made. I said this particular ice cream that I'm bringing home from Turkey, not only was it sold at the airport for transport into foreign countries, but contains a powder from an orchid that must be cooked in order for it to work. So I can guarantee that this ice cream has been cooked up to temperatures that are going to kill anything that's in it. You know what the guy said? Okay. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. All right. I mean, you seem to know what's going on. That didn't save me the last time I tried to bring something through.
Yeah, what was that? You got stopped last time.
Well, that was different. So customs, right? Customs job, I mean, I guess they're supposed to ensure the safety they have a couple of things, right? They're supposed to ensure that you're not breaking the law, like you're not bringing in rhino horn or anything like that, right? They're also supposed to ensure that you're not going to bring any deadly new pathogens in, like you're not going to bring the next, Asian longhorn beetle or something like this, right? Or chestnut blight or citrus greening. You're not going to bring in the next. By the way, speaking of blight, you have been hearing about the bird flu?
Oh, just a little bit. Tell me more.
40 million birds so far killed here in the U.S. with the bird flu. Price of eggs going through the roof. Price of eggs, which, you know, eggs. No one ever talks about. Everyone says, you know, talk about the price of eggs. Like, that's like the, you know, the standard, like, what's the bull crap, the price of eggs, right? Price of eggs, actually now an interesting subject.
Yeah.
For the first time in who knows how long. Yeah. So usually this bird flu hasn't struck kind of commercial, egg production things. This time, yeah, 40 million birds. I mean, we have a lot more than 40 million birds, but the price of eggs has gone way up. Now, I was reading recently that they think they're going to get it under control by September, but that's pretty far away.
Summer away.
Yeah, although I was also reading, luckily, that this virus doesn't like it when it's hot out. It's much like me. It doesn't like it when it's hot out, and so the prevalence is probably going to go down over the summer. We'll see. And how did I get on that? Oh, yeah, customs. So the other guy was, I had all these powders that I had labeled, right? So, I had citric acid powder, malic acid powder, all this stuff labeled. Guy comes up to me and says, they didn't identify it, so they called in the explosive expert who has this, like, little doodad that can actually detect kind of what products you have with you. And it was able to pick up the malic acid and the citric acid and I think one other, tartaric acid. And it's like, yeah, it's exactly what he said. Couldn't pick up. First of all, this guy is like super, one of these super suspicious types. You ever meet these guys who like goes through their whole life super suspicious all the time?
Yeah.
I understand that's their job because they're trying to catch people who are doing bad things. You know what I mean? But, you know, in general, you know, who the hell wants to be like that? They walk through life treating everyone like they're a potential threat. Realize it's his job. Anyway, so he says to me, you know, acids. And then he couldn't identify two acids that I had, right? He couldn't identify lactic acid. I don't know why. And he couldn't identify agar powder, which is a seaweed powder. Obviously, he can't identify it. It's a huge, like, you know, polymer, right? Sugar polymer, you know, a polysaccharide. Of course you can't identify. How the hell are you going to be able to identify that? So I said, okay, I don't understand this because half the stuff on my body you can't identify, but whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you can't identify a block of wood either because it also can't identify cellulose because it's a large chain polymer. But okay, and it has something wood that you're letting bring through that you can't identify. But sure, and the other things that I labeled were the things I labeled. He goes, well, you have to throw all of it out. I was like, all of it? But you were able to identify these things. He's like, well, but I couldn't identify these, so I have to throw out everything that I couldn't identify. And the guy was just a freak, you know what I mean? It's like, because I was like, you know, look at, he looks at me straight face, he says, acids can be used as oxidizers in explosive reactions. I was like, I can be used as an oxidizer in a freaking explosive reaction. Like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, where on your little computer database does it say citric acid should be regulated because of its potential use in explosives? And if so, where's all the other stuff that I'm going to combine with the citric acid to make into a bomb? But you can't even say those words in an airport, you know what I mean? Or you'll get instantly annihilated. And the guy said to me, he goes, you have two choices. Surrender all of this or I'll just turn you over to the Port Authority police. I was like, turn me over to the Port Authority police? For what? For what did I do that I need to be turned over to the police? So, you know, typically you can't reason with, that's like the last time I tried to bring medlar jelly in to from England. And the lady goes, you can't bring that medlar jelly in. It's a liquid. I said, oh, it is, huh? And I unscrewed the lid of the medlar jelly and turned it upside down and held it there for like 30 seconds. Of course, nothing came out because,
right,
in fact, it's a solid. And she's like, well, it can be melted into a liquid. And I pulled out a piece of plastic and I said, this can be melted into a liquid. Furthermore, I can be melted into a liquid. And she's like, we have to let you on the airplane. We don't have to let the jelly on the airplane. I was like, you are a bad human being. You're just a poor quality person. You know what I mean? It's just like... Mm. You know, because it doesn't make any sense. Like I can't make solid things that can light on fire or explosives, but like somehow medlar jelly, whatever. I don't even want to get into it. I already did.
You did.
I did. I didn't want to get into it, but I did. The rules are so nutty bags. You know what I mean? It's like, whatever. I'm on pro safety. I don't want anyone to think that I'm anti-safety.
You are pro safety.
I'm pro safety. As much as, you know, I got, hold on a second. I have to move the mic for one second. We're filming in here, and so they're, you know, moving around in our spacious studios. I actually did get two really boneheaded, because I wasn't being safe, injuries this weekend. Two separate ones.
Uh-oh.
Two separate Memorial Day stupid dad injuries. I hit my foot with an axe.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which was entirely my fault. I hit a punky piece of wood, and it glanced the wrong way. And guess what I was wearing on my feet instead of safety boots? Freaking sneakers.
Oh, well, at least it wasn't sandals.
Well, thanks for that, Jack. But yes, I wasn't beach bum stupid, but I was incredibly stupid. And the other one, installing an umbrella. You know I hate umbrellas, right? You know that, Jack?
I did not know that.
I hate umbrellas.
How come?
They're ridiculous. I get poked. They're all like, umbrellas are like the prime example of, I'm important crap on you. You know what I mean? It's like they're all about poking other people in the face or getting out of a subway and standing there at the entrance while someone else is trying to get out, fiddling around with your umbrella, or trying to walk into an entryway and poking somebody in the eye, or dripping on someone's head under an overhang.
Yeah, I'm with you on this one.
Yeah, they're crap. They're, you know, just deal with it. Wear a hat like I do. Yeah. Get a raincoat. You know what I mean? It's like very few.
A poncho. That's a lot.
Yeah, poncho. There are many other, you know what, you're just as important as I am kind of situations to handle the rain. Right. Right. Don't get me started on parasols.
So
wear a hat.
What happened with the umbrella this weekend?
Oh, well, this, you know, is a deck umbrella, which formerly I was for because I hate the sun. But, you know, this one tried to kill me. But my fault. They walk up. There's like the umbrella's not fitting into its pole properly. I'm like, OK, let me turn this so it rotates. Oh, so I rotate it and shunk.
Oof.
Took a big chunk out of my pinky.
Oof.
My fault. Stupid. So I guess the point saying is that. Is that it's the things that you don't think, like you're going out and you're splitting a little bit of wood, you don't think you're going to get damaged. Of course, when I was a kid, I was severely injured splitting wood. I don't know what the heck is wrong with me. Like, I should be thinking about it. You know, or installing an umbrella. It's not when you're using a chainsaw or like using a deep fryer that you get hurt because you're on your toes. It's when you're doing something stupid. That's when you get tagged. You know what I mean, Jack?
Oh, boy.
Anyways, this does not have anything to do with cooking issues, so I should probably get off. But Alvin Schultz, you know Alvin Schultz,
yeah.
Jack.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Long-time listener.
Yeah, yeah. Good friend of the show. Wrote in with another thing to add to our Vegetti monologues. He says, this is his quote, at Cooking Issues, are you tired of getting things jammed up in your Vegetti? And he goes, try this from the trusted folks at KitchenAid. KitchenAid now sells a spiralizer attachment for your KitchenAid.
It's more really of a, taking off, huh?
It's more of an open-air spiralizer, Jack, so you can't get anything kind of jammed into
it. Got
it. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah, because who's not tired of getting things jammed up in their vegettis? Joe Hanley wrote in, hey, Dave, what's the best way to defrost hard-frozen vac-pack steak and chicken? Easy. Water. And if you have a vac pack, you probably also have a circulator. So the easiest way is to set your circulator at like 4 or 5 degrees Celsius and then just run it at 4 to 5 degrees Celsius. It'll keep heating the water and circulating it. That's the most gentle way. If you're going to cook it right away, you know, and you don't mind the fact that it's going to go into the, you know, danger zone for a little while, then you can jack it all the way to like 18 Celsius or something like that, and it'll take it up, you know, even quicker. But yeah, a circulator in water is by far the best way to thaw a product that's been vac-packed. Like, ain't no question. You know what I mean, Jack? No question.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Can you think of a better way?
Nope.
No. You know what they used to sell for thawing things out? They used to sell large blocks of aluminum. You ever see those at the As Seen on TV things?
Yeah, actually, yes.
Yeah. They're large blocks of aluminum with, I think, typically with fins on the other side, and it's a tip. But even that is not going to beat just, like, you know, sitting in a water bath, like, circulating all the time. You know? Just won't work. Just won't beat it. Anyways. Okay. It's sad that Stas is not here, huh? We had to do it one other time. What was wrong with Stas the other time we couldn't do it?
She was in California, maybe, on the phone.
Yeah.
She usually joins us by phone.
Well, she can't because she's literally in transport. And that's like last week.
Yeah.
I was spinning stuff in a centrifuge and couldn't do it. And someone's going to ask a question later. Hopefully I get to it about like centrifuges. So we'll get to that later as we're going. Simeon Priest wrote in and basically just said that they like the book and they like the show. Well, thanks. It's very long. I don't like reading long praiseful things, so I'm not going to read it. But thanks. Anyway, and he says, my wife and I will be traveling to NYC next week for a short vacation celebrating the end of the semester, and we'll most definitely be making Booker and Dax one of our must-sees. Can't wait to get that first liquid nitro chilled glass in front of me. Well, thanks, and, you know, hopefully we'll see you there. By the way, Jack, did you know this? Istanbul, formerly, or Istanbul, I guess, formerly right. Constantinople, right?
Yep.
Familiar with this from the They Might Be Giants song. did you know that, so for those of you that aren't from New York City, we have kind of an irritating habit of wherever we are, New Yorkers, and, you know, back me up, anyone, New Yorkers, right? Yeah, New Yorkers.
Yes.
When you say that you're going back to New York, you don't say, I'm going back to New York City. You just say, I'm going back to the city.
Yes,
it's super irritating for other people because you could be in a city as large as yours. You're like, you could be in Mexico City, which is like much bigger than New York. You know what I mean? And you could say, oh, yeah, I'm going back to the city like tomorrow. And you're like, what city? Which one? And you're like, what? The. And it's like super irritating New York habit. But strangely, I looked up that Istanbul is roughly translated as a variant just meaning the city. So they're the same way we are. They're like, they're the same thing.
What, arrogant?
I wasn't going to put it that way. Say extreme love of their city.
Or that.
Extreme love of their city.
I have a caller on the line, by the way.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. This is Justin from California.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
All right. A little sweaty, biked over, but all right. Also inhaled something on the street. It never fails that when I'm biking, as soon as I go a little bit over the limit of what I can do with breathing through my nose, I breathe once through my mouth and I suck some sort of particle into my lungs and spend the rest of the bike ride hacking and wheezing all the way over, invariably. Anyway, go ahead.
All right. So my cooking question is, but I just got a centrifuge, the CR412 off eBay.
Nice. How much did you pay, if you don't mind my asking?
I paid about $400.
Good deal. Nice. With buckets?
Good deal. It's 100% Oregon.
Nice.
At least from what I can tell, I've spun it up to 4,500 RPM, and it's working.
Beautiful.
The thing that I'm doing right now is I'm trying to disinfect the unit, and I put it through a concentrated chlorine bath, and then I pressure cooked it, and I noticed that there, when I poured out the concentrated, a lot of red or a purplish color was pouring out of the bucket.
Huh.
And it seems like if I take like a paper towel and I rub it on the inside of the cups, there's like a purplish film. It's almost like the color rouge.
Hmm. Very CSI. Yeah. Huh, well, that has not happened to any of mine. Now, let's just make sure we're talking about, these are black anodized aluminum buckets, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's some sort of, like, something busted in them once, obviously, and all the buckets or just some of the buckets?
all the buckets.
Do you know who had it before you had it, what they were doing with it?
No, I don't. I was actually going to call them. Sometime soon, or yeah, at least try and get in touch with them. I bought it from a thrift store. So,
a thrift store? What the heck kind of thrift stores do you have? That's unbelievable.
It was on eBay, and then I offered the person cash since they're local, and they just happened to be from a thrift store.
It's like, hey, I'm going to pick up some old t-shirts, an army jacket, a belt, and a centrifuge. It's crazy. Thrift store.
Pretty much.
Yeah, and there's no tags on it? Like from like who repaired it before or anything like that?
No. Hmm. I mean, it looks like it's in good condition.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I don't know what the red is. Look, don't use anything highly abrasive on the inside, but get a Scotch-Brite, wear gloves, scrub it, and see whether you can get that stuff to stop coming off. You've killed, with the pressure cooking and the bleach, you've killed pretty much every bioagent that I can think of. Will bleach do prions? I don't know. And you're soaking it and scrubbing it. But I would make sure that you get all of that, all of the gunk out of it. Can you see the gunk when you're just looking at it?
Yeah. It's like a kind of like a powdery. It's like really stuck on there. But it's kind of like a powdery sheen that you see. If you put it up to the light, you can see like a purple haze.
And purple haze, nice, strong. Now I got that song going through my head. You've ruined me for the whole day. You know, some of the old Juans used to have, or they still do, plastic inserts that go into those buckets to hold test tubes. And I wonder whether it's just like years of like that powdering those things up. Like, does it look like it could be plastic dust, or it looks like a liquid, like it makes the whole liquid that color?
Not I mean, not sure.
If it could be dust, I don't know. I would just take a Scotch-Brite, okay, and just, like, gently Scotch-Brite it, see whether you can get that stuff off. Use a mild detergent, like one that's meant to go onto aluminum. I mean, I obviously don't dishwash these things because the dishwasher detergent will eat the aluminum the same way that they'll eat an aluminum pot. You don't want to weaken the surface. But see whether you can get that off, and then, you know, a couple more good bleach soaks. The pressure cooking will kill anything bio, with the exception of, like I say, prions. But scrubbing and maybe an extra bleach, because the problem is also you want to make sure that there wasn't anything hiding out underneath the gunk that the bleach couldn't get to the first time around. So once it's clean, you want to go with one last kind of bleach-a-rama. There wasn't this red gunk or purple gunk around the inside of the stainless containment vessel, was there?
No.
Yeah, okay. So if that's clean, like, you know, couple good bleachings on that propped open and let dry should get you going. But, yeah, I would get the gunk off because who knows what it is. Especially, it's less of a concern if you're going to spin in buckets, but I usually in bottles in the buckets, but I usually spin directly in the buckets. But you have to be super, super happy with the cleanliness of the buckets if you're going to do that.
Okay. I'll give that a shot.
Yeah, but all in all, great find. Let us know what happened. Refrigeration still works? You said it was a CR, right?
What's that?
You said it was a refrigerated unit, right? You said CR?
Yes.
Yeah,
is
the fridge still work?
Yes.
Okay. Here's a couple pointers to anyone that has this kind of centrifuge out there. Here's what typically goes wrong with it. It's going to stop spinning as quickly. It's because you probably need to replace the brushes. Make sure that you take like a non-gunking eraser or something and clean off the copper on the rotor on the motor before you put the brushes back in, or you'll probably eat the brushes down again. You can get the brushes for a couple of bucks. Ozark Biomedical stocks them, and you can get them also from, I think, Granger if you happen to know the size. The other, maybe even McMaster, I'm not sure. I've had on those things the brake units go on me, and you can just clip them and not have the brake anymore, although it's nice having the brake. Sometimes the solenoids for the lids go wonky, but you can just take off the front, make sure you put it back on before you do it, and fix that. And I've had the refrigeration go on me a couple of times, the actual controller for it, not the refrigerant, in which case you can put a separate controller on it or just put the refrigeration on manual. But they're good, solid units. Should work for a good long time.
Great. Great. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. Good luck with it. Hey, Jack, should we take a commercial break?
Yeah, why don't I just read this text from Stas first?
All right.
Just got out of airport. Hate everyone.
That's like except for the airport, that's every day.
That's it.
Coming back with cooking issues.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
And we are back. Hey, you know what I didn't notice before, Jack?
What?
Steve Jenkins calling off Fairway a little bit. He's like, you're not going to find this at the Fairway butcher counter. Whoa!
Yeah, whoa.
Whoa! Calling him out.
Now, that's what makes an ad effective, though.
Yeah, when someone's like, hey, you know what? You know, like, you know, Fairway, like the place that I put on the cheese map, remember them? They don't have this stuff. Shame on them. Yeah. Big call out. Had you noticed that before?
Yeah, I did. Powerful stuff. Heritage Foods USA, the only place to get it.
Yeah. Wow, the only place. I like the way he says red wattle.
I like the way he says Navajo.
Navajo, true. We talked about when I tested all of the lamb breeds. Not all of them, but I tested like four or five lamb breeds for the Easter. We talked about that, right?
Yeah.
Delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Delicious. In the tandoor, world's greatest cooking, my favorite current cooking implement. I'm like, look, some point I'm going to have to do a big study on different kind of cooking implements for like different, like I'm going to have to do a lot of work. It's going to take, maybe I should write that in my next book. You know, I still haven't figured out what my next book's going to be about, Jack.
Really?
Yeah. I got to figure out my next book.
We should crowdsource that. Here's speaking of which, I have a caller on the line.
Oh, really? Oh, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I know your great love of cured meat products. Mm. And I wanted to hear your personal, just what your personal opinion would be. There's such a convoluted argument between nitrates and nitrites and whether or not we should eat them in our cured products because carcinogenic, what have you. There's a ton of stuff out there that doesn't have that, but they have to up the celery, whatever, to get it to those levels. Do you have any issues or think nitrates or nitrites are safe?
Oh, yeah, they're safe.
I just want to hear your opinion.
They're safe. They're safe. Look, the fact of the matter is that all the stuff that's labeled uncured with big old quotes that you get at the Whole Foods, some of which I enjoy, like Nyman Ranch bacon, I enjoy it. I purchase it, mainly because, I like the way that they source the – and, you know, have the pigs raised. That's mainly why I buy it. I think that the nitrates and nitrites argument is complete bunk. First of all, if the bacon is pink, right? If it's pink and stays pink when you cooked it, i.e., if it is bacon, right? It has nitrites in it. So then the question is, where are you getting the nitrites from, right? Are you getting it from sourcing nitrites, or are you taking celery or some other green thing that is like just soaking up a bunch of it from the ground and then concentrating it from that form to add it? Either way, same effect. Same product, really, same effect. It's just hocus pocus. It's more BS on the level of saying that a flavor is all natural just because they haven't synthetically created a new compound where there wasn't another. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you're dealing with functional equivalents, both as far as the meat is concerned and as far as your body is concerned. The nitrites are there to provide cured taste, cured color, and to prevent botulism, frankly. So bacon is one thing because it's cooked at high levels. So the argument in bacon is one of against, you know, nitrosamines, right? Because whatever. I don't know what the current state of causing cancer with nitrosamines is. I really don't. But like I said, if it's pink and if it's bacon, then it's got that stuff in it anyway, and I don't care how it got in there. And furthermore, I don't think that there's, you know, any research that I think is decent that shows that there's a high enough level of worry in eating. Because frankly, you're not your great grandpa or great great grandpa going off to the California Gold Rush in the 1840s, and the only thing you can freaking survive on is dried cured meats because that's all you can carry in your backpack, right? I mean, I'm presuming that's not the life you lead, which means that the vast majority of your food intake is not from cured meats, and so you're eating a relatively small, especially because, as opposed to your great great grandpa, all this stuff is fairly highly titrated now. So they're not adding a boat ton extra of this stuff than they used to. And in fact, we're using for everything except for country hams, you're using nitrites instead of nitrates. The nitrites dissipate even more quickly and use in smaller amounts. So really, your overall risk level, even if there is a risk, your overall risk level is relatively low, and I would say don't worry about it, especially if you're eating a lot of cured meats that don't require a lot of cooking, or any cooking for that matter, like salumi or whatnot. But it's one of those things that I think is really overblown, and the whole uncured pink stuff with the celery really just gets me ticked off because the problem with it, I think, is that consumers believe that they're getting something that they're not. Consumers believe that they're somehow buying health, and they're not. You know what I mean? They're just paying extra for someone to have to jump through a hoop to get a label that looks friendly for the exact same result. You know what I mean? And that is an irritant to me.
Yeah, it's an irritant to me as well.
Yeah. I hope that helped.
Oh, that was a fantastic summary. Yeah, and my grandpappy ate way more sodium than I do.
Of course they did.
Because he ate all that.
Because they didn't have a fridge. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Or my great-grandfather didn't have one. You know what I mean? So, but it's like, I don't know. And, luckily, I think we're coming off of – these things go in waves. Like particular hatred for any one of our normal foodstuffs comes in waves. And I think hopefully the anti-salt wave is crested and crashed and we're, back into reality. Although you never know. Big food companies still spend a lot of time and energy trying to reduce sodium for one or more. Some reasons valid, some reasons not valid. But
Isn't it the same thing like with salt products? They get all these like highfalutin, supposed to be better for you salt products, and it's still the sodium compound. It's the sodium compound minus whatever minerals or whatever else they want to treat it or harvest it with.
Correct.
It's the sodium compound.
That is correct. Now there are so the things that they can do. So let's say there are people, right, who are sensitive to salt and should cut down their salt because they're prone to have blood pressure spikes as a result of salt intake, right? Right. Okay. And so what they can do, like milligram per milligram, salt is going to affect your body the same way no matter what. I don't care. You know what I mean? If it's harvested by Tibetan monks in the Himalayas, whatever. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean?
Virgin Tibetan monks.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Well, exactly. Although Tibetans, interestingly, Buddhists still eat meat, right? Because you have to at those high altitudes, right? You need the fat. So these guys are still eating yak and whatnot, plus yak, but whatever. But it's a whole separate discussion. What I'm saying is the salt is the salt. However, there are people that can engineer salt delivery systems and salt to make the equivalent amount of salt taste saltier to you by altering the way, for instance, on a potato chip, which is a dry salt application, they can form salt into shapes like spheres that taste saltier for a given level of salt, just because a lot of the salt that you eat, you might not even ever taste. You know what I mean? It might just go into your body without it actually hitting your tongue in a way that you can taste it. So they can do things like that. They can add also other things to augment your perception of saltiness in the food without there being salt in there. They can also add – so salt, aside from being salty, clearly increases your perception of other flavors. It's a flavor – it's not just its own tastant on the tongue. It's an enhancer of other tastes and flavors. So they have other things that can do that that are not salt, right? They can boost, for instance, savory umami and get some of the similar kind of like flavor-enhancing techniques that you can with salt. So there are things they can do to alter the salt in there that aren't kind of hokum. I think that, look, all what's hilarious about this is that most people who are anti-salt are anti or anti-nitrites are somehow anti-processed foods, right? But what they don't understand is that the amount of processing that actually goes into creating products that are lower in that but are still packaged goods is higher than if they had just used the normal crap to begin with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, to get the amount of celery you have to perform that same ability that a regular nitrite would do, it's a lot.
Yeah, I don't even know what the concentration levels are or how the exact kind of process is. But it's just one of those things that people, they believe, they want to believe something. And,
honestly, whatever you do next for a book would be a lot of fun to get some of those myths and write on them. I would enjoy reading.
Right, well, there's a lot of books out now. They're coming out now. It's a tough subject. In general, kind of like the psychology and the kind of science of what we eat in this realm is there's a lot of books being written from multiple sides. So like there's a book called The Dorito Effect that just came out that has
good book.
Yeah, I mean, I have my issues with it, but yeah, I just read it. And, a couple of years ago, there was Sugar, Fat, Salt. And which I had a lot of problems with, actually, because I thought the basic tenet of that book was they were like, food companies are trying to make their food as delicious as possible. Stop it! Which doesn't make sense to me. But the Dorito Effect kind of picked up where that took off, right? And kind of the argument of that is showing the argument of the book. It just came out, right, Jack?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, I think the argument of that book is more that they're making stuff taste good But that's messing with your biology because it doesn't have the nutrients that those tastes would normally signify. Anyway, there's a lot of work on that side. The problem is a lot of the work that is kind of calling BS on movements like the anti-salt movement or like the fake nitrites are written by people with a real axe to grind. And it's hard to kind of write something that hits in the middle road that doesn't piss everybody off. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're always selling you the alternative when they grind the axe.
Exactly.
That's why they're grinding the axe.
Exactly. So, like, for instance, like the genetically modified the anti-GMO lobby. Let's just take that for an example. Like, now look, from a scientific standpoint, it's pretty damn clear that there's no problems with it, right? And that in fact people are pushing to regulate something that is much safer than other processes that they might wish to regulate first. For instance, people are pushing for GMO labeling on GMO products, but I'm not saying that I don't want anyone to get mad at me, right? If you want, like, whatever you want, this is fine. I'm just presenting kind of what I think. But there's the people who want GMO products labeled, maybe what they don't realize is that in a genetic modification, you're putting a specific gene in to an organism because you think that that gene will help do something, and it's a gene that has a known function in another organism, right? That's what we're talking about. Now, you know what doesn't ever need GM labeling or can be labeled as GMO-free? Here's something that can be labeled GMO-free. You take and you bombard seeds with high-intensity radiation or mutagens, straight-up mutagens. Now, I'm all for this too, by the way. I'm not against this. I'm just saying that the people who are anti-GMO, you'd think they'd be anti this. You can bombard these things and cause spontaneous mutations that may do something you like. They may do something you hate. But here's one thing they are: freaking unpredictable, because they're spontaneous mutations due to mutagens and radiation. You grow these things and you get something that you like, and you don't have to label it at all. You can label it organic and you can label it GMO-free. Now, that makes no freaking sense, and it's not really what the anti-GMO lobby wants. If you actually talk to the GMO anti-GMO lobby, which I have in various kind of in the MOFAD debates that we've done and over the years, what their argument actually really boils down to is they're anti-big corporation. But no one wants no one wants to have that conversation, right? It's not really the genetic modification, because if you're like, what about this genetically modified plant? They're like, well, that didn't work. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, they're particularly against one large corporation, but that's part of the issue.
Yeah, but the thing is like, what we should do is we should just have the conversation about Monsanto or whomever. There's a couple other ones, but we should just have that conversation. But for some reason, no one is willing to have – very few people are willing to have – there are some. I forget the name of the author. I don't know why it went out of my head. But basically, he wrote a book that said, you know what? The problem is that food is too important to have in the control of big corporations, right? That's the tenet of the book. I was like, okay, finally, someone who's just being honest. This is that they're anti-big corporation controlling the food supply. But once someone makes that argument, well, then you can have a reasonable discussion about what the alternatives are. You're like, okay, are you really willing to abandon kind of like the system that we have now, and what would the alternative be? That's a reasonable discussion versus the GMO, which it seems to me to be kind of a like you're trying to squat. Monsanto would still be in business if there was no genetic modification. Let's be clear on this. Monsanto would still be trying to run the seed trade in the U.S. with or without genetic modification. Like, we could talk about patent laws being problematic. There's all these things that can be talked about as being problematic, but very few people are having an honest discussion. And I don't know whether or not it's possible to write a book that deals with that or even partially deals with that without just falling into a flurry of crap from both sides that have access to grind, the corporation, pro-corporation side and the anti-corporation side. It's a kind of a weird space to be in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's every documentary and blog post you read on the subject. It's just a torrent of crap from both sides.
Right, right. So when you have a torrent of crap from both sides, like, where's the market for the middle? And I don't know, because, it takes a long time and a lot of energy to write a book. And
well, there is no market for the middle. That's not what sells. It's either the cheaper, where they're complaining about GMO products to sell, or the non-GMO products that they can, save their bodies like they would want to save their souls by ingesting holy foods. That's their mindset.
Right. And the real problem is, if you read if you read books on either side, and even I'm saying the reasonable books on either side, so like oh, I forget the one written by a person who does genetic engineering and her husband who's a farmer, organic farmer. That's an interesting book. Or Mendel in the Kitchen, which is pro, obviously pro. That was written by, what's her name, Nita Fedorov, well-known GMO expert. Or if you read on the other side, any one of the number of books that everybody reads, you can see kernels of good arguments in both sides, not really so much on the hatred of GMO in general. I don't see the teeth in that. But, you know, but it's just they always bring their BS baggage with them. You know what I mean? And that's the problem. But you're right. There's no market for the middle, at least not that I can see. I don't know.
Well, I appreciate the lively lunchtime discussion.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
And I've got one more caller here.
All right, caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave. Good afternoon. I have a friend who really loves mimosas, and I was wondering if you had any kind of, like, interesting ideas for variations, like doing anything clarified or, like, forced carbonating. Like, if you ever try, like, forced carbonating white wine or kind of anything like that.
Yes. Okay. So you're crinkling up a little bit, but here's the problem with the mimosa. So your friend already likes mimosas, right? So here's the thing. You can't change the fact that they already like a mimosa. So a mimosa is lightly carbonated because the orange juice in it can't be carbonated that highly, right? Also, I mean, they're not making mimosas with actual champagne, right? Are they rich? Are these friends of yours rich?
Not quite.
Okay, so they're probably using cava or prosecco. I'm just guessing. The easiest way to do this – here's the other problem, though. Now, you can clarify – you can straight clarify – orange juice, but if you straight clarify orange juice, it turns it tastes, and this, I always say this even though I haven't had it in years, but it tastes like Sunny D or Tang. It no longer tastes like orange juice, it tastes like orange drink, right. So what you're going to look for is more of an Orangina kind of carbonation level, and so with that, what I would do is I would just put your orange juice through the finest filter you can. First of all, obviously, if you're going to fresh squeeze it, then put it through a fine chinois, and then if you can get it through a paper towel or something just to get rid of almost all the big particles, right? Chill it down hard and then carbonate just the OJ. Obviously, if you're buying at the supermarket, just buy a no pulp guy. Just carbonate it like five times. And what you're doing there is, so particles do two things. Particles in your juice are their own nucleation sites, right? Which is problematic. Also, the pectin in the OJ is, you know what? You probably could reduce the pectin by putting SPL and not clarifying it and still have the taste be right. Huh, that's an interesting idea. I've never tested that. Huh, just thought of it. Anyway, so there's pectin in there, which is causing foaming, but also particles have air trapped on them. So you're not going to get away to change the fact that the particles themselves are nucleation sites. But by carbonating like five, six, seven times, you'll be blasting the air that's trapped on those particles off of them and making it easier for you to get good carbonation. But then I would have a bottle of carbonated juice, and I would have your bottle of bubbly separate, and I would pour them together. And this way, for those of you who don't want it to be mimosified, it doesn't have to be mimosified, and you're not throwing away a bunch of bottles of bubbly at the end of the day if you don't finish it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. I'll give that a try.
All right. And then some other things, if you can clarify, that are really good with champagne. In fact, I just did it in Greece and haven't done it in a long time. Clarified strawberry juice in champagne. Then you carbonate the strawberry juice. Clarified strawberry juice tastes delicious and carbonates well. You're probably going to have to add a little bit of extra sugar depending on what time of the summer it is and what the bricks of your strawberries are when they come in. Usually I like to take strawberry juice up to about 16 bricks, somewhere around there. And like sometimes they come in as low as like 12. But if you get them up like 16, 18, and then you do like either a 1 to 3 or a 1 to 4 with bubbly, it should be pretty good.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much.
All right, give it a shot. Let us know how it works.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Okay.
All right. We got running out of time. Just a heads up.
Oh, my God. Oh, geez. Really?
Yeah.
All right. So Uriel wrote about glycemic load. We're going to have to get to that next week. Jim Guarnieri wrote in about cocktails for a wedding. for that he has to do for his sister. Now, the question is, I don't have time to get into it now, Jim. Can it wait another week? Tweet us in. Otherwise, I'll try to put some stuff over on Twitter. Doesn't like carbonated stuff. And also, he kind of calls Nastasia out, so I need Nastasia here so I can call out. But let's make sure we can go another week, have him write in. Michael wrote this in. Hello, lovely people. I did some inside round in large Ziploc freezer bags at 56 Celsius, which is not that hot, for 24 hours. The bags broke. Is that time temperature combo too much for Ziplocs? Also, do you need a puffing gun to make puffed rice cakes, the white, light, airy, bland, dry, tasteless style of food item? Michael, they should not. That time temperature is not too much for the Ziploc, not at all. Look, if they broke on the side seams, you have a faulty bag. If make sure you're not using the one with the fake zipper pull thing. Make sure it's just a regular seal on top. The other ones always leak. But if you had leakers in that or punctures, you got faulty ones. The Ziploc freezers, which are the only ones that I use, should never fail like that. Shame on you, SC Johnson Wax, a family company. Who I think is a manufacturer. Russ Bryan wrote in, and he has some coffee roasting questions, and how do you get good coffee out of a popcorn popper? I'm not going to have the time to get into that, but go to sweetmarias.com, which is where I get my beans, and they have list after list of how to use a Whirly Pop, which is what I use. Oh, I assume you meant a Whirly Pop and not an air popper. Air poppers are totally different, but luckily Sweet Maria's has good advice on both. They're going to give you much more detailed advice than I can give you. If you read that and you have more questions, ask me specific questions on that, and I'll get back to you. Franklin wrote in on puffing millet. I want to puff my own millet. Can I use a popcorn machine? Assuming also you mean a Whirly Pop and not an air popper, because millet is too tiny to pop in an air popper. It'll just spray out all over your kitchen, be an embarrassment, and like little BBs all over the ground. Can I take it from dry? Can I do it without oil? Is there a machine I can purchase that is not expensive that will do it perfect for me, Franklin? Okay. Millet's a bunch of different – there are a bunch of different kinds of millet, right? And I don't know whether millet will puff on its own. What you should do – it just as a test, is take some of the millet you have. Don't try to do it dry right away. Puff it in oil like you would popcorn. You don't even need it. You can just do it in a pan with a lid on it and oil and see whether it pops. If it pops, then you're good. If it doesn't pop, then you can cook it. Cook it until it – soak it, then cook it, then dehydrate it slightly. If you dehydrate it too much, it won't pop. If you don't dehydrate enough, it'll pop. You just have to get a feel for it. Then you should be able to pop it either in hot air, microwave, or in oil like popcorn, either way. But one of those should work. And get back to me and let me know if you need more information. Do I got another 30 seconds or so?
Yep.
Okay. Owen wrote in, huge fan. Without wasting any of your time, I'm curious, before I buy, what are the advantages of a larger rotary evaporator, say 4 liters, versus a smaller one, say 2 liters? Also, what is an ideal centrifuge size to get for bartending applications? Is 750 milliliters okay? And I'm going to miss a question on Kaylee Bennett about Jello shots. I'll get that next time. Okay, Owen, here's what I'm going to say. Larger flasks means you can put more in before it boils over. I would always get the 4-liter flask. Your biggest problem with a rotovap is going to be the amount of product that you can put through it. That's going to be the biggest limitation when you have it. Now, every time you have to break open the machine to clean out the flask, you're looking at another 10 to 15 minutes of trying to get another product. So if you can get a 4-liter flask, you're going to be able to put a lot more into it than a 3-liter flask, and it's really going to increase your throughput. And in general, it's just the glass that you're changing out, because the unit that can handle a 3-liter flask can also handle a 4-liter flask, right? Depending. It's not always the case. But especially if it's not that much more, the 4-liter flask is going to be a lot better. Also, get the largest neck on the flask that you can get, and the vapor duct the largest that you can get, because it is a pain to clean that stuff out. On the centrifuge, 750 milliliters is marginal if you're going to do bartending applications for large groups of people. It's fine if all you're ever going to do is lime juice, and if you're only ever going to make like half a bottle of Justino at a time. But for larger applications, you're going to want to get a 3-liter benchtop fuse with swinging buckets that can do the 4,000 Gs or so. Or if you can wait, I'm not saying that I'm working on something, but I might be working on something. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.